This is I Choose Life News and Views, sponsored by Indiana Right to Life and Allen County Right to Life, committed to defending innocent human life for all people of all ages. Your hosts are Kathy Humbarger, Abigail Lorenzen, and Scott Kump.
Welcome to I Choose Life News and Views. I'm Kathy Humbarger.
I'm Abigail Lorenzen.
And I'm Scott Kump. I Choose Life News and Views is a joint project of Allen County Right to Life, Indiana Right to Life, and Bot Radio Network in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
This program is sponsored in part by Rock Hill Design, serving nonprofits and entrepreneurs with personal branding, print design, and web creation. Learn more at rockhilldesign.com.
And now, the pro-life news.
This is Kaylee Hendrickson filling in for Scott Kump. According to the National Review, in March, two journalists from the Center for Medical Progress were charged with 15 felony charges for recording conversations between Planned Parenthood employees talking about what appears to be illegal fetal tissue trafficking. But on June 21st, 14 out of the 15 charges were dropped due to being legally insufficient. The California State Attorney General's office has until mid-July to file a revised complaint. This from Pro-Life Action Ministries. Planned Parenthood abortionist in St. Paul, Minnesota, would, quote, break the baby's neck if the child was born alive, according to a new video just released by Pro-Life Action Ministries. This would be a violation of both federal and Minnesota law. In the video, a former Planned Parenthood client says that when she went to Planned Parenthood earlier this year for a late-term abortion at 22 weeks and one day, she asked the two abortionists, quote, if you guys were to take him out right now while is his heart rate still, you know, going, what would you guys do, unquote. According to the woman, one of the abortionists looked at the other one, then looked back at the client. Quote, and she told me that we don't tell women this, and a lot of women don't even ask this question. But if we proceed with the abortion and the baby was to come out still alive and active, most likely we would break the baby's neck, unquote. This would be a clear violation of Minnesota's Born Alive Infants Protection Act, which, similar to federal law, requires that, quote, all reasonable measure consistent with good medical practice shall be taken to preserve the life and health of the born alive infant, unquote. On June 27th, Live Action, a pro-life organization founded by Lila Rhodes, released an article claiming that Twitter has suppressed their advertisements, saying that they are offensive and inflammatory. Twitter will not allow their ads until they delete, quote, all of our tweets calling for the end of taxpayer funding for Planned Parenthood, all of our tweets for undercover investigations into Planned Parenthood, and any ultrasound images of pre-born children, unquote.
Joining us today on I Choose Life News and Views is Dr. Priscilla Coleman, who is a professor of human development and studies at Bowling Green State University in Ohio. Her PhD training was in lifespan development psychology at West Virginia University, graduating in 1998. After a four-year post at the University of the South in Tennessee, Dr. Coleman joined the faculty at Bowling Green State University in 2002. She has written over 50 peer-reviewed journal articles in various disciplines, including psychology, family studies, education, and medicine, among others. She's currently on the editorial boards for five international psychology and medical journals. Dr. Coleman has published more peer-reviewed articles on the mental health implications of abortion than any other researcher in the world, and she frequently presents her research to audiences across the U.S. and elsewhere. In recent years, she's spoken in Australia, England, Chile, Germany, Ireland, Poland, and Portugal. In 2012, Dr. Coleman presented research findings at Parliament Houses in the UK, New South Wales, and in Queensland. She has also been invited to speak at the UN on more than one occasion and has served as an expert in several state and civil courts across the U.S., as well as testifying before U.S. Congress. And we are so privileged to have her join us today. Hi, Dr. Coleman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
So what pulled you into research regarding abortion? I noticed that your thesis was on maternal self-efficacy beliefs as predictors of parenting competence and toddlers' emotional, social, and cognitive development, yeah, which is a mouthful, but it's really sort of after birth and into child rearing. What directed your research to that earlier phase?
Okay, well, I've been actively studying all reproductive outcomes since about 1992. My primary interest has been in the psychological impact of abortion because it is so neglected, or had been very neglected, in academia. So my master's thesis dealt with the transition to parenting and first-time mothers, and then the doctoral dissertation dealt with how mothers' ideas about parenting and their confidence, how that impacts actual outcomes in young children, their emotional development. And recently I looked at women who placed for adoption, birth mothers, how they experience the separation and continue to live their lives. And so that's a new topic for me just in the last couple of years. But the bulk of my career, over 35 journal articles, have dealt with the psychological ramifications of abortion. And so I think what happened initially is it was a topic that was of interest to me because I had known people personally who had had abortions, but the psychology literature just presented it as a very benign experience, unable to harm women in any way. And I thought, this can't be real. And so I was curious as a scientist to, you know, really study it. And so then I started, the first study I did was at James Madison University with college students, men and women who had been part of an abortion experience. And it was intrigued me that the males were just as badly impacted as the women, similar levels of anxiety and guilt and all kinds of things. And so then I continued to study that kind of abortion on the side. When you're in academia, as biased as the whole environment is in terms of any research that indicates politically incorrect results, you have to kind of be careful to protect your career. So I continued with the attachment research and the parenting self-efficacy. And when I was tenured at Bowling Green, I felt freer to do this topic. And I definitely have academic freedom here. It's been a wonderful place to work for 15 years.
Great.
And so I just was I just continued to do primarily the abortion research. And it's very important because pro-life legislation needs evidence. There isn't any way we can really change the laws in this country without empirical data to support laws like a waiting period. We indicate, in the literature, it suggests that women struggle with this decision and they need time and they need counseling, and we need to look and see if they're in any high-risk groups. And so without the data, we can't change society. And so now the information has been actively used. I think there are 9 states now that require counseling on the adverse psychological effects of abortion. As women learn more about what it really means and get the truth, they opt out much more frequently and they have their children. But if I had to pinpoint exactly one point when I decided this is a topic for me, I had a college roommate, an undergrad, who had actually had a, she went home, she was from a very religious conservative background. She went home for Christmas break and she had an abortion, didn't tell her parents. And when she returned in the spring, she had a full-blown psychotic episode and she had to be hospitalized, left campus. She was hallucinating, that auditory hallucinations. We were driving just out in the country and she actually went to get ice cream and she heard the person on the radio talk about the abortion, and he was actually just announcing sports scores, but she was hearing, and the guilt and the fears about her parents finding out, and it was just horrible. And so that left an impression. I thought, this is not just an easy thing for women. So that was really, that was when my curiosity and my concern kind of was raised initially. I was only 18 years old then.
Interesting. So did that influence sort of your schooling path then, or did you already have an idea that you wanted to go into research?
Well, actually, it's interesting how people's personal lives kind of send them on a trajectory. Well, I adopted my sister became pregnant, and it was an unintended pregnancy. She had some mental health issues, and I had 2 sisters who tried to convince her to abort, and I convinced her to have the child. And then I promised that I would do anything. I would even, you know, raise the child if she just would have her. And so she had her. Jill's now 34 years old. She just had a baby herself.
Great.
And so that experience, you know, really impacted sort of my whole interest in academia. Jill had some emotional problems. She had been in foster care for a while. And so I went back to school to try to figure out how to fix Jill, and then just what did she need? And when there are those deprived conditions in terms of attachment experience, there can be, you know, horrific effects. And so I was just studying everything I could find on early emotional development, and then ended up getting a master's. And then after that, I found I enjoyed teaching, and so I thought I was getting my PhD just to teach. And then the research really captivated me. So yeah. It wasn't like I planned a career in academia. It just sort of evolved from my experience with Jill. And I just, you know, believe if you're pro-life, you should help raise these kids, you know?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's wonderful. I love that story.
Thank you.
It's wonderful when God pulls you into a path that's so clearly a passion for you, and he makes it a passion too. And
he does, yeah, for sure.
When it's so clearly applicable to your life. Yeah. It's very rewarding that way. Yeah.
Well, sometimes it does feel oppressive, you know, attacked from the other side, you know, about, you know, your everything about you is kind of out there. If you're raising concerns about women's health that go counter to the societal trends, and you're the messenger. And so there are times when, you know, I feel like, oh, I can't take any more of this.
Right,
like reading the Wikipedia that is bull, like so much on that is just outright lies. And there have been people in Ireland and Australia who have tried to correct it, and it gets reverted back. So that does wear on you, but over the years, you just kind of accept that that's part of your life, you know?
Yeah, that's quite a thing to have to accept. I think most of us don't end up needing to accept that ever. So thank you for doing that for us and doing that research.
There are a lot of warriors out there who are doing similar things. I mean, there's a lot of people studying all kinds of adverse effects, physical and psychological, and it just go out on a limb because it is such a central issue.
You mentioned that you've written over 35 articles on this. Do you know how many studies? Well, I'm sure you do know how many studies you've done.
Well, the different articles, most of them are empirical, meaning that their data was analyzed and collected and analyzed. Some of those papers are narrative reviews where mm-hmm. I summarized what's known in the professional literature. And probably the most important one that I've published was published in the British Journal of Psychiatry in 2011. And what made it important and helpful when serving as an expert in for various states, was a meta-analysis, and that means it's a quantitative synthesis of what's known, not just kind of picking and choosing articles that are in the literature and describing it in a haphazard way. Mm-hmm. With a meta-analysis, you have scientific criteria for the studies that you include, and then it allows you to derive a numerical representation of the effect of mm-hmm. something. So the bottom line with the meta-analysis was that, and this is now, you know, based on 22 studies, almost a million women. It was or closer to 900,000 women. And the bottom line was women who have had an abortion compared to women who have not have mm-hmm. an 81% higher risk of mental health problems. And because it synthesized so many studies objectively, it's been very useful in terms of litigation.
So 81% higher risk of mental health issues after an abortion is what that meta-analysis came up with?
Yep.
So can you talk to us a little bit about why that's the case?
Sure. And then maybe it's funny how I don't remember the title, but I remember the details. But the outcomes that I measured were depression and anxiety and substance abuse. But there are many theories about that. A lot of it depends on the woman's initial orientation to abortion. If a woman is pro-life and believes that abortion is killing, it's going to be much more likely to lead to guilt and depression and self-reproach and all kinds of negative thoughts in that realm. But even when women may believe they're pro-choice and don't see abortion as any major traumatic event, they may experience difficulty later in a wanted pregnancy when they're looking at fetal development information. There may guilt may hit. So it's not like there's a path that every woman who suffers goes on. It's mm-hmm. such an individual experience, and it is based on not only your beliefs about the life of the fetus, but also if you experience some bonding. And there are some really good studies out of Australia that have shown that even women contemplating abortion, totally determined to have one, as early as a couple months into the pregnancy, experience bonding behaviors. They're not even planning to carry. And so if there's any kind of maternal orientation, more likely to suffer. Younger women, adolescents, often feel like they don't have any choice. They pushed into it by a boyfriend or parents, or they're hiding it. And also younger women often delay it. And so then they're okay. having a later term abortion. There's mm-hmm. more trauma associated with that. So there's a whole set of risk factors that really should be evaluated when a woman presents at a center. And if they have, if a particular woman has four or five of those, there is a high probability that they will suffer afterwards. So there's guilt, there's feelings of bereavement. You know, some women will have multiple pregnancies after an abortion to try to replace that baby, and you never really replace. So then, you know, it just becomes a really complicated psychological experience. And some women who have had abortions may function well, like in the job, even in relationships, but they often have kind of a detachment or a desire to just stay busy and not really look at it. And so there are all just so many different ways that women adapt or live around the fact that they've had abortion. And for, I would say, just in all of the many testimonies I've read and heard and all the data that's out there, my sense of it is the only women who really emerge from an abortion experience with healing are those that find God and experience conversion and forgiveness.
You know, we hold our Christian faith so dearly, but it is always interesting to me when we see it kind of come out in black and white that this is the only way that you can actually be healed from something. You know, so for you to say the healing that I've seen has come through Christian faith and people coming to the Christian faith and right through God, like that is really an amazing statement, I think.
And there are women who don't experience adversity. You know, there, you know, that always kind of shocks me, but it's probably only about 20 to 30% that actually suffer psychologically. So there are 60 to 70% walking around there, and it's not really, or they claim that it's not impacting them.
Interesting. So let me repeat this back to you, make sure I have this right, Dr. Coleman.
Okay.
20 to 30% of women do suffer some sort of psychological trauma after an abortion.
Yeah.
And that could be years down the line.
Could be, yes. And unfortunately, we don't have enough longitudinal work that's been done. The studies that there are a few, there was an excellent study in, conducted by David Ferguson out of New Zealand. And he actually was a he's a pro-choice researcher, but his data clearly indicated that long as, you know, 25 years later, women have increased risk of depression and suicide ideation and, you know, anxiety and so forth. So we do need to, and there was another study that came out not too long ago that looked at women at menopause when their reproductive lives were over.
Right.
And so they may not have regretted the abortion early on, but when they realized that, you know, that was the only child I was ever going to have, that can be a very difficult time as well.
Yeah. And I can imagine, too, there's some sort of correlation similar there with people who experience physical trauma from the abortion itself. So, like, you know, you hear about the cervix being weakened. And so then these women are unable to carry pregnancies past a certain point because physically their body can't hold the baby anymore. And so do you see a correlation there, too, for women who actually have a physical trauma that keeps them from carrying children to term in the future, that they then experience higher rates of depression and substance abuse and that sort of thing?
I don't think there have been any studies that actually looked at women who experienced physical trauma or physical issues, like, you know, after that resulted in, like, miscarriages, the inability, you know, to hold the baby or mm-hmm. other kinds of physical issues that prevented another pregnancy. People, you know, there are those theories out there and hypotheses, and exclusively looking at the physical health, like, is a, you know, a whole other area. There's strong associations with increased risk of breast cancer, increased risk of premature birth. And so even if you're able to conceive afterwards, you may not be able to hold the baby. And the interesting aspect of this is abortion is associated with a significantly increased risk of significantly preterm delivery, not just a couple right. weeks early, but very early when the baby may not survive.
Yeah, so we're talking 22, 24, 26 weeks.
Yes.
That's one thing that we in Fort Wayne are looking at really closely right now, too, is because in Indiana, we have the highest infant mortality rate here in Fort Wayne.
Really?
In one of our zip codes. Yeah, I believe it's the 46806 zip code. And so you sort of, you get that label and you're like, wow, the highest in Indiana, right here in Fort Wayne.
Wow.
And so one of the things that we're looking at as a possible contributor is previous abortions that physically the women have trauma there. And so their bodies can't carry the baby to full term and they're having very preterm births.
Mm-hmm. And without the use of medical records, that's kind of hard to determine. About half of the women out there who've had an abortion will conceal it. If you're polling them, they won't admit to an abortion because of the shame. And so what happens is you end up with women in a no abortion group that actually had an abortion. So that dilutes the effects and the ability to, so that, you know, may happen unless you're actually looking at medical records.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
I found the title of the meta-analysis.
Oh, great.
Like, it's Abortion and Mental Health, a Quantitative Synthesis and Analysis of Research published from 1995 to 2009. And it's in the British Journal of Psychiatry, 2011.
Now, Dr. Coleman, I don't know why you couldn't remember that title. It's so easy. I'm sure after you put out a couple studies.
I sort of labor over the titles, too, so you would think I'd remember them.
Well, I imagine, you know, putting out a couple studies that have similar content and coming up with titles for them that, it might be a little tricky to remember them after a while. Yeah, well, great. Well, we'll link to that again on our website so that people can find that and take a look through it if they're interested.
I also would like to share with you, I started a nonprofit organization several years ago. There are three goals. One was to get the information out there. That was a primary goal because you can't count on major media.
Right.
When the meta-analysis was published, it was covered all over the world, but the U.S., only CBS, and Christian media. So the main goal was information dissemination, but also research collaboration and to provide an entity for experts when states need people to serve, credentialed scientists and medical doctors to serve as experts. So I kind of do that on the side. I'm not much of an administrator, but I at least got it going. Mm-hmm. It is a nonprofit. Been kind of looking at a director to somebody who's more into that. I just want the information out there. And I do a lot of press releases or like news stories when a study comes out, critiques and things. But it's called the World Expert Consortium for Abortion Research and Education. And that's WeCare is the...
Yeah.
So there's a lot out there on the website. The meta-analysis is described, a summary. There's all kinds of information at the WeCare site.
Great. And we'll link to that too on our website so people can find that. Because again, that's a title that's kind of hard to remember. The World Expert Consortium for abortion Research and Education.
And Education. Actually, my daughter, who I adopted, came up with that when we were playing around with names. And
cool.
WeCare is easy. So.
Yeah, WeCare is easy. And it makes a lot of sense. Can you talk to us a little bit more? I'm interested to know about your service as an expert in these bill hearings. Lots of people haven't been into their state house and haven't seen these hearings go on. And so can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've served as an expert for various states on bills that involve counseling before abortion or waiting periods, informed consent. And I've been actively involved with South Dakota, feels like forever, 11 years now. And we had great success with the 1166 bill. So that women now in South Dakota are told that if they have an abortion, they'll be ending the life of a whole separate human being. And that's absolute law. We have to say that. And
that's incredible.
And they're also warned about the increased risk of depression and suicide. So all of that is embedded in that law. And we're now litigating another law. It's the 1217 House bill out there. And that bill requires 72 hours wait period. It also requires that women be who are in high-risk groups be given more information and intensive counseling. So there has to be this preterm counseling. And there's the part that we're still litigating most strongly because Planned Parenthood is adverse to it. In this 1217 bill, women have to go to a crisis pregnancy center and hear both sides before they can actually get an abortion. And so that's a novel bill. I also have been involved with Missouri and North Dakota. I've done affidavits for Texas, Ohio. So just quite a bit. And I've been involved in civil cases, too, where a woman is harmed by abortion and then they sue the provider. I was heavily involved with the Stacey's Alley case in New Jersey.
Okay.
Horrible story. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm not.
But her dad has a non-profit now that he's not pro-life or pro-choice, kind of pro-information. Mm-hmm. Stacey didn't receive information. She was Stephen Brigham performed the abortion, and he's been in the news a lot. But anyway, the supposed fact sheet said things like, it's common for women to have 20 or more abortions, and they often feel a sense of hope and happiness afterwards.
Oh my
gosh. So this poor kid at age 19 went in there. Her family didn't know about the abortion, only the boyfriend's father. They took her there, and the boyfriend said that he would marry her if she went through with that. The next day, the relationship ended. She started drinking, and sadly, she hung herself in her room less than a year after the abortion and left a note saying, now she can be with her unborn baby, and it was just horrible.
Yeah.
So there are cases like that that don't always end in a death. There was one in Cincinnati I was involved in where the girl had been impregnated by her soccer coach and she was underage and she went to a Planned Parenthood facility. They didn't report statutory rape. Mm-hmm. And this girl experienced many of the psychological problems that we see in the literature. So there's those kinds of cases as well.
Wow. Well, thank you for providing that information to people, and especially in those cases for being that expert there and for doing the research. That's really, I mean, it's really incredible work that you're doing.
Oh, well, thank you, Abigail.
And it sounds like it's hard work. I'm not sure I could do that. So I'm glad that you're doing that and that God's put it on your heart to do it.
I probably couldn't do what you're doing either. That we all have our talents and our callings. But I'm 56 now, so I'm getting a little tired looking forward to retirement. But I think I'll always be writing and always be involved on some level.
I'm sure. Well, I don't think it'll ever stop pulling at your heartstrings. So
that's for sure.
Yeah, you'll be involved one way or another. Well, thanks so much, Dr. Coleman, for joining us.
You're welcome.
And for sharing with us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to I Choose Life News and Views. If you have questions about this program or if you'd like to support the fight for life, please call 260-471-1849 or go to iChooseLife.org, because without the right to life, no other rights matter.